The temperature in my house slowly dropped, hours slipping deeper into the still morning. I tried to sleep and couldn't get warm. My mind wouldn't get still. My thoughts bounced from Lucy to Benton to the awful scene where I'd just been. I saw a hemorrhaging woman dragged across the floor and small owl eyes staring out of rotting flesh. I shifted positions continually. Lucy did not call. Fear picked at my loose threads when I looked out the window into my dark backyard. My breath fogged the glass, and the click-click of sleet turned into knitting needles when I dozed, to my mother knitting in Miami when my father was dying, knitting endless scarves for the poor in some cold place. Not a single car went by. I called Rita at the guard booth. She didn't answer. My eyes blurred as I tried to drift off again at 3 a.m. Tree branches cracked like guns going off, and in the distance a train lumbered past the river. Its forlorn horn seemed to set the pitch for a percussion of screeching, clanking, and rumbling that made me more uneasy. I lay in the dark, a comforter wrapped around me, and when daylight bruised the horizon, the power came back on. Marino called minutes later.
"What time you want me to pick you up?" he asked, his voice hoarse from sleep.
"Pick me up for what?" I blearily walked into the kitchen to make coffee.
"Work."
I didn't have a clue what he was talking about.
"You looked out the window, Doc?" he asked. "No way you're going anywhere in that Nazi mobile of yours."
"I've told you not to say that. It's not funny." I went to the window and opened the blinds. The world was rock candy and glass coating every shrub and tree. Grass was a thick, stiff carpet. Icicles bared long teeth from the eaves, and I knew my car wasn't going anywhere anytime soon. "Oh," I said, "I guess I need a ride." Marino's big truck with its big chains churned up Richmond's roads for almost an hour before we reached my office. There wasn't another car in the lot. We carefully made our way into the building, our feet almost going out from under us several times because the pavement was glazed, and we were the first to challenge it. I draped my coat over my chair in my office, and both of us headed to the locker rooms to change. The rescue squad had used a transportable autopsy table, so we didn't have to lift the body off a gurney. We unzipped the pouch in the vast silence of this empty theater of death and opened the bloody sheets. Under the scrutiny of overhead diffused light, her wounds looked even only more terrible. I pulled the fluorescent magnifying lamp closer, adjusting its arm and peering through the lens. Her magnified skin was a desert of dried, cracked blood and canyons of gashes and gaping wounds. I collected hairs, dozens of them, those pale, blonde, baby-fine hairs. Most were 6 or 7 or 8 inches long. They adhered to her belly, shoulders, and breasts. I didn't find any on her face, and I placed the hairs inside a paper envelope to keep them dry. Hours were thieves slipping past, stealing the morning, and no matter how hard I tried to find an explanation for the ripped, tightly knit sweater and underwire bra, there wasn't another one except the truth. The killer had done it with his bare hands. "I've never seen anything quite like that," I said. "You're talking about incredible strength."
"Maybe he's on cocaine or angel dust or something," Marino said. "That might explain what he did to her, too. It might also account for the gold dot ammo, you know, if he's doing drug deals on the street."
"I think that's the ammo Lucy said something about," I seemed to recall.
"Hot shit on the street," Marino said. "Big with dopers."
"If he was whacked out on drugs," I pointed out as I placed fibers in another envelope, "then it strikes me as rather improbable his thinking would be so organized. He put out the closed sign, locked the door, didn't go out the back armed door until he was ready, and maybe washed up."
"No evidence he did," Marino let me know. "Nothing in the drains or sink or toilet. No bloody paper towels. No nothing. Not even on the door he opened on his way out of the storeroom. So what I'm thinking is he used something, maybe part of his clothing, a paper towel, who knows, to open the door with so he didn't get blood or prints on the knob."
"That's not exactly disorganized. Not the actions of someone under the influence of drugs."
"I'd rather think he was on drugs," Marino said ominously. "The alternative's a really bad one. I mean, if he's the Incredible Hulk or something. I wish...
He stopped himself, and I knew he was about to say he wished Benton were here to offer his experienced opinion. Yet it was so easy to depend on someone else when not all theories required an expert. Every scene and every wound resonated the emotion of the crime, and this homicide was frenzied, and it was sexual, and it was rage. That became only more apparent when I found large, irregular areas of contusion. When I looked at them through a lens, I saw small, curvy linear marks. Bite marks, I said. Marino came over to look. What's left of them? Beaten with blunt force, I added. I moved the light around, looking for more, and found two on the side of her right palm, and one on the bottom of her left foot, and two on the bottom of the right.
Jesus,
Marino muttered, in an unnerved tone I rarely heard. He moved from the wounded hands to the feet, staring.
What the hell are we dealing with, Doc?
He asked. All of the bite marks were contused so badly I could make out the abrasions of teeth, but nothing more. The indentations needed for casting had been eradicated. Nothing was going to assist us. There was too little left to ever make a match. I swabbed for saliva and began taking one-by-one photographs as I tried to imagine what biting palms and soles might mean to whoever had killed her. Did he know her after all? Were her hands and feet symbolic to him, a reminder of who she was, just as her face had been?
So he ain't totally ignorant about evidence, Marino said.
It appears he knows bite marks can identify someone, I replied, as I used a spray hose to wash off the body.
Brrr,
Marino shivered.
That always makes me feel cold.
She doesn't feel it.
I hope like hell she didn't feel any of what's happened to her.
I think by the time he started in she was already dead, or close to dead, thank you, Lord, I said. Her autopsy revealed something else to add to the horror. The bullet that had entered Kim Luong's neck and hit her carotid had also bruised her spinal cord between the fifth and sixth cervical discs, instantly paralyzing her. She could breathe and talk, but not move, as he dragged her down the aisle, her blood sweeping shelves, her useless arms spread wide, limp, unable to clutch the wound in her neck. In my mind, I saw the terror in her eyes. I heard her whimper as she wondered what he was going to do to her next, as she watched herself die.
"Goddamn bastard," I said.
"I'm sorry as fucking hell they switched to lethal injection," Marino said in a hard, hateful voice.
"Assholes like this ought to fry. They ought to choke on cyanide gas till their fucking eyes pop out. Instead, we send them off to a nice little nap."
I swiftly ran the scalpel from the clavicles to the sternum and down to the pelvis in the usual incision shaped like a Y. Marino was quiet for a moment.
"You think you could stick that needle in his arm, Doc? You think you could turn on the gas or strap him in the chair and hit the switch?"
I didn't reply.
"I think about that a lot," he went on.
"I wouldn't think about it too much," I said.
"I know you could do it."
He wouldn't let it rest.
"And you know what else? I think you'd like it, but just won't admit it, not even to yourself.
Sometimes I really want to kill someone." I glanced up at him, blood speckling my face shield and saturating the long sleeves of my gown. "Now you're really worrying me," I said, and I meant it.
"See, I think a lot of people feel that way and just won't admit it."
Her heart and lungs were within normal limits. "I think most people don't feel that way." Marina was getting more belligerent, as if his rage over what had been done to Kim Luong made him feel as powerless as she had been.
"I think Lucy feels that way," he said.
I glanced up at him, refusing to believe it.
"I think she just waits for an opportunity. And if she don't get that out of her system, she's going to end up waiting tables."
"Be quiet, Marino."
"Truth hurts, don't it? At least I admit it. Take the asshole who did this. Me? I'd like to handcuff him to a chair, shackle his ankles, and put the barrel of my pistol in his mouth and ask him if he had an orthodontist because he was about to need one."
Her spleen, kidneys, liver were within normal limits.
"Then I'd stick it against his eye, tell him to take a look and let me know if I needed to clean the inside of the barrel."
Inside her stomach were what appeared to be remnants of chicken, rice, and vegetables, and I thought of the container and fork that had been found in a paper bag near her pocketbook and coat.
Hell, maybe I'd just back up like I'm on the fucking firing range and use him as a target. See how much he liked. Stop it, I said.
He shut up. God damn it, Marino. What's gotten into you? I asked, scalpel in one hand, forceps in the other. He was quiet for a while, our silence heavy as I worked and kept him busy with various tasks. Then he said,
"The woman who ran up to the ambulance last night is a friend of Kim's. Works as a waitress at Shoney's, was taking night classes at VCU. They lived together. So the friend gets home from class. She's got no idea what's happened, and her phone rings, and this dumbass reporter says, 'What was your reaction when you heard?'"
He paused. I looked up at him as he stared at the opened-up body, the chest cavity empty and gleaming red, pale ribs gracefully bowed out from the perfectly straight spine. I plugged in the striker saw.
"According to the friend, there's no indication she might have known anybody who struck her as weird. Nobody coming into the store and bothering her, giving her the creeps. There was a false alarm earlier in the week, Tuesday, same back door. It happens a lot. People forget it's armed," he went on, his eyes distant. "It's like he just suddenly flew out of hell."
I began sawing through the skull with all its comminuted fractures and areas punched out by violent blows of a tool or tools I couldn't identify. A hot, bony dust drifted through the air. 26. By early afternoon, Rhodes had thawed enough so that other diligent, hopelessly behind forensic scientists could come to work. I decided to make my rounds because I was frantic. My first stop was the forensic biology section, a 10,000-square-foot area where only an authorized few had access to electronic cards for the locks. People didn't drop by to chat. They traversed the corridor and glanced at intense scientists in white behind glass, but rarely got any closer than that. I pressed an intercom button to see if Jamie Coon was in.
"Let me find him," a voice called back.
The instant he opened the door, Coon held out a clean, long white lab coat, gloves, and mask. Contamination was the enemy of DNA, especially in an era when every pipette, microtome, glove, refrigerator, and even pen used for labeling might be questioned in court. The degree of laboratory precautions had become just about as stringent as the sterile procedures found in the operating room. "I hate to do this to you, Jamie," I said.
"You always say that," he said. "Come on in."
There were three sets of doors to pass through, and fresh lab coats hung in each airlocked space to make sure you exchanged the one you'd just put on for yet another one. Tacky paper on the floors was for the bottom of your shoes. The process was repeated twice more to make sure no one carried contaminants from one area into another. The examiner's work area was an open, bright room of black counter space and computers, water baths, containment units, and laminar flow hoods. Individual stations were neatly arranged with mineral oil, auto pipettes, polypropylene tubes, and tube racks. Reagents, or the substances used to cause reactions, were made in big batches from molecular biology-grade chemicals. They were given unique identification numbers and stored in small aliquots away from chemicals kept for general use. Contamination was managed primarily through sterilization, heat denaturation, enzymatic digestion, screening, repeated analysis, ultraviolet irradiation, iodinizing irradiation, use of controls and samples taken from a healthy volunteer. If all else failed, the examiner just quit on certain samples. Maybe he tried again in a few months. Maybe he didn't. Polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, had made it possible to get DNA results in days instead of weeks. Now, with short tandem repeat typing, STR, it was theoretically possible that Coon could get results in a day. That was, if there was cellular tissue for testing, and in the case of the pale hair from the unidentified man found in the container, there was not. "That's a damn shame," I said, "because it looks like I've found more of it, this time adhering to the body of the woman murdered last night at the quick carry."
"Wait a minute. Am I hearing this right? The hair from the container guy's clothing matches hair on her?"
"Looks like it. You can see my urgency."
Your urgency's about to get more urgent, he said. Because the hair's not cat hair, dog hair. It's not animal hair. It's human. It can't be, I said. It absolutely is. Coon was a wiry young man who didn't get excited by much. I couldn't remember the last time I'd seen his eyes light up. Fine, unpigmented, rudimentary, he went on. Baby hair. I figured maybe the guy has a baby at home. But now, two cases? Maybe the same hair on the murdered lady? Baby hair isn't 6 or 7 inches long, I told him. That's what I collected from her body. Maybe it grows longer in Belgium, he dryly said. Let's talk about the unidentified man in the container first. What would baby hair be doing all over him, I asked, even if he does have a baby back home, and even if it were possible for baby hair to be that long? Not all of them are that long. Some are extremely short, like stubble when you shave. Any of the hair forcibly removed? I asked. I'm not seeing any roots with follicular tissue still adhering. Mostly the bulbous-shaped roots you associate with hair naturally falling out. Shedding, in other words. Which is why I can't do DNA. But some of it's been cut or shaved? I thought out loud, drawing a blank. Right. Some's been cut, some hasn't. Like those weird styles. You've seen them. Short on top and long and wispy on the sides. Not on a baby, I haven't, I answered. What if he had triplets, quintuplets, sextuplets, because his wife had been on a fertility drug? Coon suggested. The hair would be the same, but if it's coming from different kids, that might explain the different lengths. The DNA would be the same, too, saying you had anything to test. In identical twins, triplets, sextuplets, the DNA was identical, only the fingerprints were different. Dr. Scarpetta, Coon said, all I can tell you is the hairs are alike visually. Their morphology the same, in other words. Well, these hairs on this lady are alike visually, too. Any short ones, as if they were cut? No, I replied. Sorry, I don't have more to tell you, he said. Believe me, Jamie, you've just told me quite a lot, I said. I just don't know what any of it means. You figure it out, he tried to lighten up. We'll write a paper on it. I tried the trace evidence lab next and didn't even bother saying hello to Larry Posner. He was peering into a microscope that probably was more sharply focused than he was when he looked up at me. Larry, I said, everything's going to hell. Always has been. What about our unidentified guy? Anything? I asked. Because let me tell you, I'm really groping. I'm relieved. I thought you dropped by to ask me about your lady downstairs, he replied. And I was going to have to break the news that I'm not Mercury with winged feet. There may be a link between the two cases. Same weird hair found on the bodies. Human hair, Larry. He thought about this for a long moment. I don't get it, he finally said. And I hate to tell you, but I don't have anything quite so dramatic to report to you. Anything you can tell me at all? I asked. Start with the soil samples from the container. PLM picked up the usual, he began, referring to the polarized light microscopy. Quartz, sand, diatomite, flint, and elements like iron and aluminum. Lots of trash, glass, paint chips, vegetable debris, rodent hairs. You can only begin to imagine all the crap inside a cargo container like that. And diatoms all over the place. But what's a little offbeat is what I found when I examined the ones swept up from the container's floor and the ones from the surface of the body and exterior of the clothes. They're a mixture of salt water and freshwater diatoms. Makes sense if the ship started out in the Scheldt River in Antwerp and then spent most of the voyage at sea, I remarked. But the inside of the clothing? That's exclusively freshwater. Don't get like that unless he washes his clothes, shoes, socks, even underwear in a river, lake, whatever. And I wouldn't expect you to launder Armani and crocodile shoes in a river or lake, or swim in clothes like that either. So it's like he's got freshwater diatoms against his skin, which is weird, and the mixture of salt and fresh on the outside, which you'd expect under the circumstances. You know, walking around on the dock, saltwater diatoms in the air getting on his clothes, but not on the inside of them. What about the vertebral bone? I then asked. Freshwater diatoms. Consistent with freshwater drowning. Maybe the river in Antwerp. And the hair on the guy's head? All freshwater diatoms. No saltwater ones mixed in. Posner widened his eyes and rubbed them,
as if they were very tired. This is really twisting my brain like a dish rag. Diatoms that don't add up, weirdo baby hair and the vertebral bone, like an Oreo. One side chocolate, the other vanilla, with chocolate and vanilla icing in the middle and a scoop of vanilla on top. Spare me the analogies, Larry. I'm confused enough. So how do you explain it? I can only offer a scenario. Fire away. He might have only freshwater diatoms in his hair if his head were immersed in fresh water, I said. If he were put headfirst inside a barrel with fresh water in the bottom, for example. You do that to somebody they can't get out, just like toddlers who fall headfirst into buckets of water, those 5-gallon plastic kind detergent comes in, waist high and very stable, impossible to topple it over. Or he could have been drowned in a normal-sized bucket of fresh water if someone held him down. I'm going to have nightmares, Posner said. Don't stay here until the roads start freezing again, I said. Marino gave me a ride home, and I took the jar of formalin with me because I would not give up hope that the flesh inside it had nothing else to say. I would keep it on my desk in my study, and now and then put on gloves and study it in sidelight, like an archaeologist trying to read crude symbols worn away on stone. You coming in? I asked Marino.
You know, my damn pager keeps going off, and I can't figure out who it is, he said, shoving his truck in gear.
He held it up and squinted. Maybe if you turned on the overhead light, I suggested.
Probably some snitch too stoned to dial right, he replied. I'll eat something if you're offering. Then I gotta go.
As we stepped inside my house, his pager vibrated again. He grabbed it off his belt in exasperation, tilting it until he could read the display.
Screwed up again. What's 531? Anything you know that's got those numbers in it? He asked, exasperated.
Rose's home number does, I said. 27. Rose had grieved when her husband died, and I thought she would fall apart when she'd had to put down one of her greyhounds. Yet somehow she'd always worn her dignity the same way she dressed, properly and with discretion. But when she learned on the news this morning that Kim Luong had been murdered, Rose got hysterical.
If only,
she went on and on, crying in the wing chair near the fire in her small apartment.
Rose, you got to quit saying that, Marino said.
She had known Kim Luong because Rose often shopped at the Quick Carry. Rose had gone there last night, probably at the same time the killer was still inside, beating and biting and smearing blood. Thank God the store had been closed and locked. I carried 2 mugs of ginseng tea into her living room while Marino drank coffee. Rose was shaking all over, face swollen from crying, and gray hair hanging over the collar of her bathrobe. She looked like a neglected old woman in a nursing home.
I didn't have the TV on. I was reading, so I didn't know about it until I heard it on the news this morning.
She kept telling us the same story in different ways.
I had no idea. Was sitting up in bed, reading and worrying about all the problems in the office. Mainly Chuck. I think that boy's as twisted as they come, and I've been working to show it.
I set down her tea.
Rose, Marino said, we can talk about Chuck another time. We need you to tell us exactly what happened last...
But you've got to listen to me first, she exclaimed. And Captain Marino, you've got to make Dr. Scarpetta listen. That boy hates her. He hates all three of us. I'm trying to tell you, you must do anything to get rid of him before it's too late.
I'm going to take care of it as soon as... I started to say, but she was shaking her head.
He's pure evil. I believe he's been following me, or at least someone involved with him, she claimed. Maybe even that car you saw in my parking lot and the one following you. How do you know it wasn't him who rented it under a phony name so he didn't have to use his car and be recognized right away? How do you know it's not whoever he might be involved with?
Whoa, 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 Marino interrupted her, holding up his hand. Why would he follow anybody?
Drugs,
she answered, as if she knew it for a fact. This past Monday we had an overdose case come in, and it just so happened I decided to come in an hour and a half early because I was going to take a long lunch break to get my hair done.
I didn't believe that Rose just happened to come in early. I had asked her to help me find out what Ruffin was up to, and of course she had made that her mission.
You were out that day, she said to me, and you had misplaced your appointment book, and we looked everywhere with no luck. So by Monday, I was obsessed with finding it because I knew how much you needed. I thought I'd check the morgue again. And I went in there before I'd even taken my coat off, she went on. And here's Chuck at 6:45 in the morning, sitting at a desk with the pill counter and dozens of bottles lined up. Well, he looked as if I'd just caught him with his pants down. I asked him why he was getting started so early, and he said it was going to be a busy day and he was trying to get a head start.
Was his car in the parking lot? Marino asked.
He parks in the deck, I explained. His car wouldn't be visible from our building. The drugs were from Dr. Fielding's case, Rose resumed, and out of curiosity I looked at the report. Well, the woman had about every drug known to man. Tranquilizers, antidepressants, narcotics. A total of some 1,300 pills, if you can believe that. Unfortunately, I can, I said. Overdoses and suicides typically came to us with months, even years, of prescription drugs. Codeine, Percocet, morphine, methadone, PDC, Valium, and phenytoin patches, to name a few. It was an unbearably tedious task to count them, to see how many were supposed to have been in the bottle and how many were left. So he's stealing pills instead of washing them down the sink, Marino said. I can't prove it, Rose replied. But Monday wasn't god-awful busy like it usually is. The overdose was the only case. Chuck avoided me as much as he could after that, and every time drugs came in with cases, I wondered if they'd gone in his pocket instead of down the drain.
We can hook up a VCR where he's not going to see it. You've already got cameras down there. If he's doing it, we'll get him, Marino promised.
That on top of everything else, I said. The press about that would be awful. It might even go out on the wire, especially if an investigative reporter started digging and found out about my alleged refusal to take calls from families and the chat room and even the subterfuge of running into Bray in a parking lot. Paranoia pushed against my chest and I took a deep breath. Marino was watching me.
You're not thinking Bray's got something to do with this, Marino said skeptically.
Only in the sense that she helped put Chuck on the road he's on. He himself told me the more bad things he did, the easier it got.
Well, I think Chucky boy's on his own when it comes to stealing prescription drugs. It's too easy for slime like him to resist. Like the cops who can't resist pocketing wads of cash at drug busts and shit like that. Hell, drugs like Lortabs, Lorazette, not to mention Percocet, can go for $2 to $5 a pop on the street. What I'm curious about is where he's unloading the stuff.
Maybe you can find out from his wife if he's out a lot at night, Rose suggested.
Honey, Marino replied. Bad people do stuff like this in broad daylight.
Rose looked dejected and somewhat embarrassed, as if afraid that her being so upset had sent her spinning threads of truth into a tapestry of conviction. Marino got up to pour more coffee.
You think he's following you because you're suspicious of his drug dealing? He asked Rose.
Oh, I guess it sounds so far-fetched when I hear myself say it.
Might be someone involved with Chuck if we want to keep going down this path, and I don't think we should dismiss anything right now, Marino added. If Rose knows, then you do, he said to me. Chuck sure as hell knows that.
If this is tied in with drugs, then what's the motive if Chuck's involved in our being followed? To hurt us? To intimidate us? I asked.
This much I can guarantee, Marino replied from the kitchen. He's mixed up with people who are way out of his league, and we're not talking small amounts of money. Think how many pills come in with some of these bodies. Cops have to turn in every bottle they find. Think of all the leftover pain medication or who knows what in your average person's medicine cabinet.
He came back into the living room and sat down, blowing into the cup as if that really would cool his coffee in a hurry.
Add that to the shitload of other stuff they're actively taking or supposed to be taking, and what do you get? He went on. That the only reason Chucky Boy needs his job in the morgue is to steal drugs. Hell, he doesn't need the pay, and that may have something to do with why he's been doing such a shitty job over the last few months.
He could be taking in thousands of dollars a week, I said.
Doc, you got any reason to think he might be hooked up with your other offices, getting somebody to do the same thing? They get him the pills, he gives them a small cut.
I have no idea.
You got 4 district offices.
You steal drugs from all of them, you're getting into really big bucks now, Marino said. Hell, the little shit may even be involved in organized crime, just one more drone bringing stuff to the hive. Problem is, this ain't shopping at Walmart. He thinks it's so easy making deals with some guy in a suit, some foxy woman. This person moves the merchandise along to the next person in the chain. Maybe it's eventually traded for guns that end up in New York. Or Miami, I thought. Thank God you alerted us, Rose, I said. The last thing I want is anything flowing out of the office and ending up in the hands of people who will hurt others or even kill them. Not to mention Chuck's days are probably going to be number two, Marino said. People like him usually don't live too long. He got up and moved to the end of the couch, closer to Rose. Now, Rose, he gently said, what's making you think what you've just told us has anything to do with Kim Luong's murder? She took a deep breath and turned off the lamp next to her as if it were bothering her eyes. Her hands were shaking so badly that when she reached for her mug, she spilled some of her tea. She dabbed the wet spot on her lap with a tissue. On my way home from the office last night, I decided to pick up shortbreads and a few other things, she began, her voice getting shaky again. Do you know exactly what time this was? Marino asked. Not to the minute. Around 6:10, as best I can say. Let me be sure I've got this straight, Marino said, taking notes. You stopped at the quick carry at about 6:00 p.m. Was it closed?
Yes. Which irritated me a little because it's not supposed to close until 6. I thought ugly thoughts, and now I feel so bad about that, too. Here she is dead in there, and I'm mad at her because I couldn't get cookies, she sobbed.
Did you see any cars in the lot? Marino asked. Any person or persons?
Not a one, she barely said.
Think hard, Rose. Was there anything that struck you at all?
Oh, yes, she said. And this is what I've been trying to get at. I could see from Libby that the market was closed because the lights were out, so I pulled into the lot to turn around, and I saw the closed sign on the door. I got back on Libby and hadn't gone any farther than the ABC store when this car was suddenly behind me with its high beams on.
Were you headed home?
Yes. And I really didn't think anything until I turned on Grove, and he did too, staying on my bumper with those darn lights about to blind me. Cars going the other way were flicking their lights up and down to tell him his high beams were on in case he didn't know. But he clearly intended for them to be on. By now I was getting frightened.
Any idea what kind of car? Could you see anything? Marino asked.
I was practically blinded, and then I was so confused. Immediately I thought of the car in my parking lot on Tuesday night when you came by, she said to me. And then you're telling me you'd been followed. And I started thinking about Chuck and drugs and the sort of horrible people who get involved in that.
So you're driving along Grove? Marino got her back on track.
Of course, I drove right on past my apartment building trying to figure out where to go to get away with him. And I don't know how I thought of it, but I suddenly cut over to the left and did a U-turn. Then I drove to where Grove ends at 3 Chopped and took a left, him still behind me. The next right was the Country Club of Virginia, and I turned in there and drove straight to the entrance where the valets were. Needless to say, whoever it was vanished.
That was damn smart of you, Marino said. Damn smart.
But why didn't you call the police?
It wouldn't have done any good.
They wouldn't have believed me, and I couldn't have described a thing anyway.
Well, you should have called me at least, Marino said.
I know. After this, where did you go? I asked.
Here.
Rose, you're scaring me, I said. What if he was waiting for you somewhere? I couldn't stay out all night, and I went a different route home.
Any idea what time it was when he vanished? Marino asked.
Somewhere between 6 and 6:15. Oh, dear Lord. I just can't believe when I pulled up to that store she was in there. And what if he was? If only I'd known. I can't stop thinking there must have been something I should have noticed. Maybe even when I was in there Tuesday night.
Rose, you couldn't have known a damn thing unless you're a gypsy with a crystal ball, Marino told her.
She took a deep, shaky breath and pulled her robe more tightly around her.
I can't seem to get warm, she said. Kim was such a nice girl.
She stopped again, her face contorted by grief. Tears filled her eyes and spilled.
She was never rude to anyone, and worked so hard. How could anybody do something like that? She wanted to be a nurse. She wanted to spend her life helping people. I remember worrying about her being alone in there so late at night. Oh, God, help me. It even crossed my mind when I was there on Tuesday, but I didn't say anything.
Her voice tumbled as if it were falling down a steep flight of stairs. I came over and knelt beside her, pulling her close.
It's like when Sassy wasn't feeling well. So lethargic, and I just thought she'd eaten something she shouldn't have.
It's okay, Rose. Everything's going to be okay, I said.
And it turned out she'd somehow gotten hold of a piece of glass. My little baby was bleeding inside, and I didn't do anything.
You didn't know. We can't know everything. I felt a spasm of grief, too.
If only I'd taken her to the vet sooner. I'll never, ever forgive myself for that. Poor little girl, a prisoner in a little cage and muzzle. And some monster hit her with something and broke her nose at that goddamn dog track. And then I let her suffer and die.
She wept as if outraged over every loss and act of cruelty the world had ever suffered. I held her clenched fists in both of my hands. Rose, now you listen to me, I said. You saved Sassy from hell just as you've saved others. There's nothing you could have done for Sassy any more than there was anything you could have done when you stopped to get your shortbreads. Kim was dead. She had been dead for hours.
What about him?
She cried.
What if he had still been inside that store and had come out just as I had pulled in? I'd be dead too, wouldn't I? Shot and dumped somewhere like garbage. Or maybe he would have done awful things to me, too.
She closed her eyes, exhausted, tears sneaking down her face. She went limp all over as the violent storm passed. Marino leaned forward on the couch and touched her knee. You've got to help us out, he said. We need to know why you think you're being followed and the murder might be connected. Why don't you come home with me? I said. Her eyes cleared as she began to regain her composure.
That car pulling out after me right there where she was murdered. Why didn't he start following me long before that? She said. And an hour and a half before the alarm went off? Don't you find that an amazing coincidence?
Sure I do, Marino said. But there have been a lot of amazing coincidences in my career.
I feel foolish, Rose said, looking down at her hands.
All of us are tired, I said. I've got plenty of room. We're gonna nail Chucky Boy for drugs, Marino said to her. Not a damn thing foolish about that.
I'm going to stay here and go on to bed, Rose said.
I continued to sort through what she'd told us as we went down the stairs and into the parking lot. Look, Marino said, unlocking his car. You've been around Chuck a whole lot more than I have. You know him a lot better, which is too bad for you. And you're going to ask me if he's the one in the rental car following us, I said, as he backed out and turned on Randy Travis. The answer's no. He's a sneak. He's a liar and a thief, but he's a coward, Marino. It takes a lot of arrogance to boldly tailgate someone with your high beams on. Whoever's doing it is very sure of himself. He has no fear of being caught because he thinks he's too smart for that. Sort of the definition of a psychopath, he said. And now I feel worse. Shit. I don't want to think that guy who just did Luong is the one following you and Rose. Roads had frozen over again, and Richmond drivers, lacking sense, were sliding and spinning all over the place. Marino had his portable police radio on and was monitoring accidents. When are you going to turn that thing in? I asked. When they come and try to take it from me, he replied. I ain't turning in shit. That's the spirit. The hard thing about every case we've ever worked, he said, is there's never just one thing going on. Cops try to connect so much crap that by the time we solve the case, we could have written the victim's biography. Half the time we find a connection, it's not one that matters. Like the husband who gets mad at his wife. She goes out the door pissed and ends up abducted from a mall parking lot, raped and murdered. Her husband pissing her off didn't make it happen. Maybe she was going shopping anyway. He turned into my driveway and put the truck in park. I gave him a long look. Marino, what are you going to do about money?
I'll be all right. I knew it wasn't true. You could help me out as a field investigator for a while, I said, until this suspension nonsense ends. He was silent. As long as Bray was there, it would never end. Suspending him without pay was her way of forcing Marino to resign. If he did that, he was out of the way like Al Carson. I can hire you two ways, I went on. A case-by-case basis, and you get $50 per... He snorted. $50, my ass. Or I can hire you part-time, and eventually I'll have to advertise the position, and you'll have to apply for it like everybody else. Don't make me sick. How much are you earning now?
About 62 plus benefits, he replied.
The best I could do is make you a P-14 at senior level, 30 hours a week. No benefits. 35 a year.
Now that's a good one. One of the funniest things I've heard in a while.
I can also take you on as an instructor and coordinator in death investigation at the Institute. That's another 35. So that's 70. No benefits. Actually, you'll probably make out better. He thought about it for a moment, sucking smoke.
I don't need your help right now, he said rudely. And hanging around medical examiners and dead bodies ain't part of my life's plan.
I climbed out of his truck. Good night, I said. He angrily roared away, and I knew it wasn't me he was really so angry with. He was frustrated and furious. His self-respect and vulnerability were naked in front of me, and he didn't want me to see it. All the same, what he'd said hurt. I threw my coat over a chair in the foyer and pulled off leather gloves. I put Beethoven's symphony on the CD player, and my discordant nerves began to restore their rhythm, like the strings that played. I ate an omelet and settled in bed with a book I was too tired to read. I fell asleep with the light on and was shocked awake by the hammering of my burglar alarm. I got my Glock out of a drawer and fought the impulse to disarm the system. I couldn't stand the awful clangor, but I didn't know what had set it off. The phone rang several minutes later.
This is ADT. Yes, yes, I said loudly. I don't know why it's gone off.
We're showing Zone 5, the man said.
The kitchen back door.
I have no idea.
Then you'd like us to dispatch the police.
I guess you'd better, I said, as the air raid in my house went on.
28. I supposed a strong gust of wind might have set off the alarm, and minutes later I silenced it so I could hear the police arrive.